Probably the biggest issue is to figure out how to hand over the operation to the next generation.
Estate planning, it's a topic nearly every ranch family will have to or has dealt with at some point. Attorney Dal Houston walks us through the various topics like the differences between a will and a trust and the differences between a revocable trust and an irrevocable trust.
But there is really a broad line distinction between the two types of trust.
Plus, discussion on joint tenancy, partnerships, and LLCs.
The LLCs have been out there for quite a while, and a lot of people know they need them, but they don't fully understand them.
Today, we pull the highlights from an old discussion we had with Dal on estate planning, and here's the deal. You might have heard it one time before, but I can guarantee you're going to want to listen in because you're going to hear something that you probably missed the first time around on today's episode of the Working Ranch Radio Show. And we welcome you here to the Working Ranch Radio Show. I'm Justin Mills. As you heard there in the opening, our topic is on estate planning. And I just want to be forthright with you here on our show today. This is actually the interview. We've pulled some of the highlights out of that interview of our conversation that we had with Attorney Dal Houston back in April of last year. In fact, I believe it was episode 115. And even though you might have went back, and if you're a regular listener, maybe you've listened to that show, but I would encourage you to stay tuned into this week's show and continue to hear this again. Partly because I feel this is a very important topic, because it is one of the reasons, and if not one of the main reasons, why we're not seeing family farms and ranches being passed on to the next generation in a sustainable manner, if at all. And so that's why I continue to pound this drum a bit about estate planning for our family farms and ranches. So that's kind of where this is backing up to, where we pulled some of the highlights out of that show, and we're going to air that here today. Now, I did want to remind you that later on in the show, as we always do, the Captain Tim O'Byrne, who is publisher of Working Ranch Magazine, will be in for this week's edition of Tim's Two Cents. And of course, meteorologist Don Day will be in to talk about our long-term weather, as we're going to be talking about the spring storms, as we're already seeing one across the northern tier of the country, and what it's going to look like for the end of March and into April as well for these spring weather storms. So be sure to tune in as we hear from meteorologist Don Day with a look at our long-term weather. Now, to turn towards our subject at hand here today, as I said, Attorney Dal Houston is joining us. He is an attorney with the firm of Benson and Houston and of Alva, Oklahoma. And Dal, thanks for joining us here today on the Working Ranch Radio Show.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate the invitation.
Now, I think part of the reason that we're addressing this topic here today is the fact that it is big to our ranches and our families, just in terms of a lot of different elements that are involved in that. From your standpoint, when you see ranchers coming into your office, what is one of the biggest issues that you're having to address from an estate standpoint?
Normally speaking, probably the biggest issue is to figure out how to hand over the operation to the next generation. And a lot of my clients will have maybe a son or sons or a child who's interested in taking over the operation, and other children who have no interest in the operation. But at the same token, that rancher, farmer, that client is wanting to be fair to the other children, and at the same time, fair to the child or children who is taking over the operation. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So as a general rule, that is one of the big things we encounter in our estate planning practice. The second would be is if we've got a situation where maybe no one's wanting to take over the operation, and what do we want to do with that land? How do we want to hold that land? Do we want to leave it in trust for our children, or do we want to distribute it to them so that as soon as that person dies, that land becomes their children's land, and now they can do whatever they want with it, whether it means selling it, potentially losing it, mortgaging it, giving it away, doing whatever. So out of those two topics, that would probably consume 80% of what my clients are concerned about.
Yep. And I think that makes sense. I think you nailed exactly what are the, just in my mind, as I asked that question, I thought, well, here's what I've had to deal with from a personal standpoint. And you kind of nailed both of those. So now that we've identified the issue, for lack of better words, or the issues, let's start to flesh out some of the tools or the things that can be used to handle estate planning. And I know a lot of these terminologies for a lot of us, we've probably heard them, but you and I were talking before we went on air here, was I'm not an attorney, so some of this stuff just doesn't stay at the top of my mind. Awareness of trust, the difference between a revocable, irrevocable, how that differs from a will, and all these kind of things. So let's just start with a trust and basically providing some definition to that and how that functions in regards to estate management.
Okay. Probably the best place to describe or define what a trust is. And there's all kinds of trusts. There's irrevocable trusts, there's revocable trusts. And what I'm going to talk about primarily when I'm talking with trust, unless I specifically say irrevocable, I'm talking about a revocable trust. And think of it as just a last will and testament substitute. A last will and testament is saying, distribute my property as follows to my children, X, Y, and Z, or whatever. And a trust that's revocable is just really a substitute for a will. But what that substitution does is really important, and that is a will has to be probated. A will has no effect until that person who made the will dies, and now that will is offered to probate. And whereas a trust is likewise created while that person's alive, but it's got aspects of it that will let you carry on normally without probating the person's estate. They can have provisions in them to say, if I've got a farmer or rancher says, I want my estate to continue on, or I want my operation to continue on, I leave the property in trust for my children. And this is a trustee who's in charge after I pass away or become incapacitated, and my beneficiaries are entitled to the income, or they shall distribute this property to them. And really, a trust can do a lot more than that. It just to try to keep it simple, or at least here in the beginning, it is really just a revocable trust. It's just a substitute for a will. Does that make sense?
Yep. So when you say it's a substitute for a will, and you maybe outlined this a little bit, but I want to make sure we answer this question. For ranchers, in light of a lot of times we're talking multi-million dollar type estates, would you suggest a trust or a will?
Well, the more complex your estate is and the larger your estate is, just by definition, you probably would be going more likely with a trust, just that it's more complex. You may have issues that come about that you want to handle expeditiously. Let me give you this example. We're in Oklahoma, and at times we will have oil and gas booms going on here. And during those times, things are happening very, very quickly, and you don't have time to sit down and do a lot. You want to be on top of things. And so let's say that you're a landowner and you're in the middle of something like that, and you want a trust. So if I'm in the process of executing an oil and gas lease, theoretically, it may not be politically correct or politely correct if you want to look at it, but somebody could have a trust and die at 10 o'clock in the morning, and somebody could be executing on behalf of that trust and on the behalf of that deceased person an oil and gas lease at 12 that noon. It just lets you continue the business without any hiccups or things that you've got to worry about. Whereas, let's say that you had a will and you had ongoing business, you had cattle in the feedlot, or that you were removing a lot of inventory, or, you know, there was always something, there was always business decisions that had to be made with third parties, banks, realtors, lenders, that type of stuff. Then a last will and testament for the person named in that document to have any power to deal with those issues has to be admitted to probate. And that by its very nature means that it had to be filed with the court. Normally, it's going to have to be set for hearing with the court, which requires notice to everybody that's a family member that's listed on that document. And so you can see by just adding that layer or those layers of things that have to happen, you've got decisions that need to be made in a fairly expeditious manner. You've now created a timeline where you cannot make those in that kind of time period. Does that does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. Well, let's take a break here. My guest today is attorney Dal Houston. He's an attorney with the firm of Benson and Houston out of Alva, Oklahoma. Today, as we are talking estate planning and topics and issues, the tools that can be used in that. We were just learning a little bit about a trust versus a will. We've got more to cover. We're going to be talking coming up in the next segment. What's the difference between a revocable trust and an irrevocable trust? We're going to be talking joint tenancy, LLCs, a lot of things that we still have to cover. So stay with us. We'll be back with more on the Working Ranch Radio Show after this.
When your goal is to help animals reach their full potential, health matters. Diamond V offers a fresh perspective on animal health, a perspective that supports gut health, strengthens immunity, and enhances performance. For those who choose to invest in keeping healthy animals healthy, feeding Diamond V makes a statement about another dimension of profit, where margins are measured by confidence in your future. To get a fresh perspective, visit DiamondV.com, because animal health deserves a healthier approach.
And welcome back to the Working Ranch Radio Show. I'm Justin Mills. We're glad to have you joining us here on our program today. My guest is Dal Houston. He's an attorney with Benson and Houston out of Alva, Oklahoma. And we are talking on estate type topic here today. As you were just hearing in our first segment, Dal did a good job of explaining and kind of probably, in my opinion, dead-onning the topics or the issues that he sees from ranching families that are wanting to come in, and how do they handle their estate? How do they set this estate up in terms of trying to pass it down to the next generations, being one of the big topics that folks are coming in the office. And I know for each and every one of us that are in ranching, we're probably, that just rang a bell for a lot of us in some way, shape, or form. We talked a little bit in the first segment about a trust or a will, and Dal, you talked a little bit about the advantages of a trust versus a will, especially when we're talking a little bit, typically our ranching estates are a little more complex than just a house in town sort of a thing. So when we get to that, then the topic we start hearing is, okay, we got revocable versus an irrevocable trust. So let's talk about the differences between those two.
Okay, sure. And it happens every day in my office that somebody will come in and say, my neighbor down the road told me I needed an irrevocable trust, or I didn't need one, or they had done a trust and it worked really good. But there is really a broad line distinction between the two types of trust. The revocable trust is really, as I said in the beginning of the interview, more of a will substitute. It is just substituting for a will, and it's trying to avoid probate. It is probably addressing estate taxes to some degree, but its still main purpose is to say, upon my death, this is how I want my property distributed or held or whatever. An irrevocable trust, on the other hand, is a trust that takes effect at the time you do it, and it says it's irrevocable. And what you're trying to do there is transfer property and value out of your estate. And now, I'm not saying that estate taxes still don't affect farmers and ranchers, but in today's world, the estate taxes, and they go up every year, but they started out in 2000, I believe it was 10 at $10 million, and they've escalated from there. Mm-hmm. Now, before that time, estate taxes were dramatically lower than that. You could have estate taxes that kicked in, I believe, at $750,000, $1 million. And so it didn't take owning very much farm and ranch land or any other kind of wealth for that matter before you had an estate tax issue. And what they would do is create these irrevocable trusts that you would put property in that, if you did it right, would not be considered part of that client's estate when they passed away. And hence, its value wasn't brought into the calculations for estate tax purposes. So as a general rule today, while estate taxes are still around and irrevocable trusts are still around, their use isn't as great today as it used to be when estate taxes were lower. And I know people like to complain about taxes and estate taxes, but boy, I tell you what, 10, 13 years ago, estate taxes were a lot bigger issue than they are today. And I'm not saying they're still not a big issue, but again, with that higher exemption amount, it sure takes a lot of people out of having an issue of having estate taxes. So the main difference is if somebody's talking about trying to shift property and get property out of their, in that value, out of their estate, they're probably talking about an irrevocable trust. On the other hand, if they're just talking about how do I distribute the property on my death, they're talking about a revocable trust. Does that make sense, Justin?
Yeah, it does. So real quick, I want to just make sure I got this part right, because you said now irrevocable trust would be if somebody's wanting, you're going to see those used more likely in transferring property out of the estate while you're alive. Give me a little bit more definition of where you would see that from a ranching standpoint. Or the need for that versus, you know, for,
you know, one of the places that we would see it is still in estate taxes. And you know, there's a lot of large farming and ranching operations that will, in fact, have estate tax consequences. And so you're still going to see it in those larger operations. The other place you would probably see it is let's say that you wanted to be shifting your operation to the next generation. And your options are, I can just deed that property to them, and now it's out of my control, though. So if I deed it to my son, or I've got a client that deeds that property to their son, and now the son is running the farming operations, they can potentially lose it, mismanage it, whatever. Whereas if you said, I want to transfer that over, but I want to protect that property from mismanagement, from creditor problems, that type of stuff, I might create an irrevocable trust. So instead of just the client giving that land to their child outright, they create an irrevocable trust with these are the trustees, and it may even be that the child's a trustee. Mm-hmm. But what you've done is you've created a break between them actually having firsthand ownership of that and just having the right to use it, subject to the terms of those trusts. Does that make sense?
Yep. And I could see that. That'll help some folks. All right, let's go to the next element of this. And that is, let's talk on a couple issues and we can get to them respectively. But let's first hit joint tenancy.
Yeah, joint tenancy is generally a very simple estate plan and a simple concept, whether it be with a bank account or with a piece of land. It's the way you title the ownership of that. So I'll use a piece of land, and that is I buy a piece of land and I want to take it as a joint tenancy with my wife. So it just says from the grantor to Dow Houston and his wife as joint tenants. And what that does is those very words have legal meaning. So the first one of us that would die, the property would vest in the survivor. Mm-hmm. And so it is very effective in moving property between spouses upon their death. Where we find it to not be in a very effective estate plan is when clients want to use that to bring it to the next generation. So I've often seen you know, a wife come in whose husband is deceased, or a husband whose wife is deceased, and say, you know, hey, I've got three kids and I want a simple estate plan. Just put them on as joint tenants with me. And that's where we really see a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. Just because all of a sudden that is considered not just a gift for gift purposes, but you have vested ownership of that property in the in those people that you've now listed. And again, that's not a bad thing when it's you and your wife, or your wife and your husband out buying a house, because they're going together normally and it's a joint effort, and you're listing both of them as co-owners, and that with that rights of survivorship that vests in the survivor. But now all of a sudden you're doing with this next generation coming up. And oftentimes it's just they're doing it for convenience sake. And whereas the parent still considers that property theirs, and it can lead to a lot of problems, as we're kind of talking about before the interview.
Well, and I think we're going to talk more about this, folks. We're going to take a break here. And I think one of the things that Dal just mentioned there, you know, joint tenancy has some advantages. But the thing I wrote down in your comments there was, if you're planning to pass this estate down, this may not be, joint tenancy may not be the ticket. Folks, stay with us, because we do have more topics. For example, we're going to be talking LLCs. And I also want Dal to address partnerships a bit as well, because I do know that a lot of ranches are set up in different ways, and their books are, their personal books and their ranch books are kind of all in the same, and some topics like that that I want to talk about a little bit as well. Just a reminder too that our program here today is not intended to be legal advice. It's really only designed to provide some explanation and some considerations for you in your estate planning. And just like in any legal matter, it's important to seek your own counsel in this. So stay with us. When we come back, we're going to continue on the Working Ranch Radio Show after this.
Capitalize on crossbreeding with Gelve and Balancer bulls. Raise replacement females with added fertility, increased longevity, and greater productivity. Gelve and Balancer influenced females wean more pounds of calf per cow exposed. In the feed yard, Balancer influenced cattle offer increased performance, improved feed efficiency, and have excellent carcass merit. Balancers add the pounds, make the grade, and deliver the value. Make your crossbreeding count with Gelve and Balancer Genetics.
And we welcome you back here to the Working Ranch Radio Show. I'm Justin Mills. My guest today is attorney Dal Houston with the firm of Benson and Houston out of Alva, Oklahoma. And we're talking on estate planning. And if you missed the first couple of segments that we've already had in my conversations with Dal, I would encourage you to go back and listen to that, especially if estate issues or estate planning is a big topic to you as a rancher. And I really think, as I said earlier, if you had to list the top three items or things that are really weighs on the minds of ranchers in terms of your estate planning and how that is all put together and managed, is really a big, big thing. And we've already talked with Dal about trusts versus a will, and also the difference between a revocable trust and an irrevocable trust. And just when we finished up in the last segment, he addressed joint tenancy. Now, Dal, I want to move on to some other things to be looking at or considerations as well. And that is limited liability, LLCs. And that's something, of course, for my own operation, that's the way we're set up. But I want you to expand a little bit on the pros and cons of an LLC.
Okay. You know, obviously, LLCs have been out there for quite a while. And a lot of people know they need them, but they don't fully understand them. And what I like to do is first just say an LLC stands for a limited liability company. Okay. And so I don't want to overburden the subject, but if I'm a farmer or I'm any kind of person that runs a business and I do not have an LLC, so I'm just operating Dal Houston, maybe it's Dal Houston Ranch, and somebody, you know, I've got a pickup going down the road and it goes over the median and hits somebody, they can sue Dal Houston, and they can sue and get a judgment, if their damages are enough, against everything that Dal Houston has. Okay. So if that's my pickup, my ranch, my cattle, let's say I'm an attorney, so I've got my own business in town. I've got some investments. Anything that is Dallas Houston can be attached and satisfy that judgment. Whereas if I've got a limited liability company or an LLC, whatever you want to call it, that the liability that somebody can seek is limited to what is in that company. So let's just say that I own a ranch and my cattle operation is within the LLC. So it's got the pickups, maybe it's got the livestock, but the land is not in there. And so that pickup is now driving down the highway as a wreck. The only thing that somebody who's injured by my company or that company could get would be the assets within that company, again, which would be the pickup, potentially the cattle, whatever other assets were in there. And so we see a lot of your more risk adverse ranchers and farmers segregating their business in such a way as to limit the liability as best they can, to really use some strategic thinking. And that would be like this. I've got a lot of ranchers who have their own semi. And as we were talking before the interview, that semi is a big, powerful truck driving down their highway with a load full of cattle, and people driving it are tired. To me, the ranch itself has very little liability. It's just sitting there as land, in a lot of cases, doing nothing except letting cattle graze on it. Whereas that semi is going down that road hundreds of miles, depending on where you're hauling cattle to or from, and through cities and everything else. So strategically, a lot of clients would say, one of the first things I'm going to do is limit my liability on that semi to an LLC. And the only thing that's going to be in that LLC is that semi, and maybe they got multiple semis, so that transportation wing of their operation is limited to that company and that company only. So if one of those trucks would have a wreck, the only thing they could get would be the assets of that company, which again would be the truck itself, maybe some equity in the truck and that type of stuff. They might also strategically plan further. So if you've got a farmer and rancher who says, you know, I farm some, I ranch some, I've also got a semi that runs down the road, they may create an LLC for their trucking operation. They may create a farming LLC for their farming operation, because again, probably the next biggest liability that I see is running big tractors up and down the road with big wide machinery. And so all of a sudden, instead of putting the land in that LLC, it's the tractor. And then what the land does is they rent the land to that farming operation or to the ranching operation. So the ranch and the farmland is always protected from these more higher risk activities. And we have some clients who taken a step further. Maybe they have a custom harvesting operation and they create a separate LLC for that. So they break it off into so many different units that if any one of those units of business had some kind of problem, any liability is hopefully contained within just that unit.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. So that, I think that's where a lot of that stems from. I think a lot of ranchers, they will identify with some of the things that you've talked about that do expose us from a liability standpoint. I think let's take a break here. And when we come back, we're going to get into the other topic that always comes up when we're talking about estate planning. It seems to come back to this at some point and often is responsible for holding that up. And that is the cost of doing that. We'll address that with Dal when we return on the Working Ranch Radio Show. Welcome back to the Working Ranch Radio Show. My guest today is attorney Dal Houston. As we are talking on the issue of estate planning, we've already had a lot of insight into the different types and things, parts of getting an estate set up. And Dal, just a couple more questions as we have to tail out here in just a bit. And I would be remiss if we did not head down this subject, and that is the cost of setting this all up. I don't think there's probably a ranching family that would not see the value in the tools that are available that we've talked about here today, and trusts and LLCs and various things of that nature. But at the same time, there's just a real fear of moving forward on it, because what is it going to cost? When we look at cost, there's definitely, it's a double-edged sword. You can get what you pay for. It's pretty simple to set up joint tenancies or to do transfer on death deeds. May not cost as much, but then there's caution there, especially when it looks, when you're wanting to pass your estate down to the next generation or have it managed in some way, shape, or form in the future. So when we look at the cost of setting our estates up, really, I think the question is for a lot of us is, man, what is this going to cost me? That really is a big concern.
Oh, I understand it is. And you know, of course, we're tied in with other professionals, just like accountants and things like that. And the only thing that I can really say to that is, yeah, I can, you know, like so many things, I can avoid some costs and say, okay, I'm going to do the cheap estate plan and everything. And I have clients that come in and say, you know, they'll be talking to me about an estate plan, and they say, well, gee, this thing's pretty complex, and it looks like it's going to get pretty expensive as well. You know, when my dad died, he just put all three of us kids on as joint tenants. And as they're going through and telling me the story, maybe it did work out, but it was just, in some cases, they tell me, and then they add just that little bit of the story to say that had it just changed slightly, the wheels would have just run off of it altogether. And so I think it's like anything in life. And that is, you know, if you're looking at something and you say, I've got $100,000 worth of assets, then you probably look at, okay, what do I invest? What is a good rate of return to invest in those assets to protect them and to plan for them? On the other hand, if I've got $1 million of assets, should I be willing to spend more to figure out how to protect those assets or distribute those assets on down the road? And some people, just to be honest, you know, it depends on everyone's value of a dollar. Some of the way the people put $1 million ranches and operations together was watching every penny and being careful with every penny. On the other hand, obviously, the bigger your operation, the more thought and probably the more precision that needs to be put into the planning to make sure it goes on. So, you know, me personally, I obviously try to watch my money as best as anybody. And that is a really hard question to say, how much should I put into it and how much should I not? There's not a great answer and there's not a wrong answer.
Yeah.
But I do know the more complex your operation is, it's just going to require to be a prudent operator and to accomplish the things you want to accomplish. You probably want to spend more time and effort than you would if you had a very simple operation.
Yeah. Well, I can guess that the third topic, as you said, when most people come in, 80% of the people come in with two questions in regard to passing down the estate. I'm guessing the third one is, how much is it going to cost me? So
that is normally a question.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Final question here. We're going to have to kind of hustle through this, but and again, you know, folks, you need to seek your own legal counsel on this. We're just providing some thoughts for you, some explanation on things. But if you just kind of roughly could just outline a way that you would set up an estate, a ranching family's estate, let's start from the top and work that down. What would that look like?
You know, I've got a more or less normal go-to strategy, whether this would be a trust or a will. When I'm looking with a client who has the next generation who is coming into the operation and maybe children who aren't. So let's say they've got four children and one of them's coming into the operation and the other three are not, but yet that client is wanting to be fair to the children who are not in the operation. And normally one of the things I recommend and that I just start with is to say, listen, what I would do is I would create, if it's a farm, for instance, I would create a farming LLC, and I would put in that LLC all the farm equipment, farm pickups, that type of stuff. And I would leave the land that you own outside of that. And so the land is basically a landlord mom and dad are a landlord, and they lease that land to the LLC. Then as that child starts coming into the operation, they buy into that LLC. So every tractor now that is purchased, for instance, the child is also signing as a co-maker on that note. They're buying into it. They're earning equity in that LLC as time goes by putting their time and effort into that LLC. Then what you do is the estate plan itself says something like this, and that is, upon my death or death of client, all my interest in the LLC goes to child one. That is the child who's coming into the operation. Everything else, which would be the land, the outside investments, that type of stuff, are divided between my kids equally. What you've accomplished by that is you've still treated the children that's not in the farming operation fairly, or at least if I've attempted to treat them fairly. You've also have rewarded that child who stayed home and worked within the LLC or in the farming and ranching operation. You've let them slowly acclimate in there. And so what they are getting is that farming operation, the moving, the rolling stock of it, the that type of stuff, but the real value for most people still is being locked, is still being held in the title of those lands and things like that. You can do the very same thing if it's a ranching operation. That is kind of my go-to place where I originally start. Now, that's not to say that every farmer or rancher I have ultimately ends up there, but at least that is the starting point generally for talking about, here's how I would do it. And then there may be nuances to it that they may add this to it or take this away from it in that. But as just as a general rule of thumb, when I have someone come to me, that's how we start the discussion.
Okay. And I think that's helpful. And it really, the concept here today, folks, was really to get your mind rolling. I know estate issues, passing down the estate, it's got to be one or two in topics that weigh probably on the minds of those that are wanting to pass the estate down. And so I know it's a big topic here in the ranching industry. Dal, I appreciate you meeting with us here today and doing this. I know we've kind of scratched the surface on a few things. We could probably go deeper on some other things, but we're limited a bit here on time. And I do appreciate you joining us here today on this topic.
Oh, you bet. I'm glad to help.
And again, my guest today has been Dal Houston. He's an attorney with the firm of Benson and Houston out of Alva, Oklahoma, guiding us down a little bit more insight here on this topic of estate planning and estate management. And I know if you're like me, I even have more questions. There's deeper issues that I thought of, especially as we were talking about some scenarios in which he works through with clients to potentially start that process, some questions I have as well. So if you have a question, please feel free to reach out to me. You can shoot me a quick text if you're thinking about it right now, 307-363-COWS. That's 307-363-COWS, or my email address is justin.workingranch@gmail.com, because we can continue to look at some of these things in later shows as well if we get enough response on this. But really, again, here today was to provide some guidance in this. By no means is this intended to be legal advice. It's just designed to be an explanation and provide some consideration for your estate planning purposes. And you really need to consult with your own legal counsel as you move forward with all of this. But the thing in all of this that I also realize that it really is important. I realize this is a tough subject. Mainly it's tough because we think of two things: the cost of putting it all together, and then the discussions that may have to happen with our families and our family estates in order for this to be set up. And when we look at that and the amount of time and the effort and energy that have been put into these estates over the years to put it all together, and then for it to just crumble because we did not move forward with good planning. Well, I'll tell you what, just it's hard for me to deal with, because I don't like to see our ranching families, A, split up, both our relationship-wise and also land-wise. So when you look at this, think about your heritage and what you want to leave behind. Do you want to see the broken walls of an estate just come crumbling down upon your death? Or do you want to see it transfer down to the next generation in a good way? And so think about those things. Stalling out and not doing anything is definitely not something that would probably be well advised. Again, I want to thank my guest today, Dal Houston with Benson & Houston out of Alva, Oklahoma. Now, if you have questions and you want to reach out to him, their website is BensonHouston.com. They've got a rich, long history in the state of Oklahoma, but I'm sure he'd be willing to answer a lot of questions. Something we didn't even get in here to today because it's a whole other subject would be 1031s, but that's something he's pretty savvy about as well. So I appreciate him joining us here on our program today. Well, stay with us. Coming up after the break, meteorologist Don Day standing by with a look at our long-term weather. And of course, the Captain Tim O'Byrne, publisher of Working Ranch Magazine, will be in for this week's edition of Tim's Two Cents. We'll have that right after this.
Looking for the perfect gift for a gardener or weather enthusiast? Introducing the Tropo, a precision rain gauge that has revolutionized both reliability and convenience. Expertly engineered by meteorologists, the Tropo gauge boasts rugged durability, impeccable accuracy, and precision to the hundredth of an inch. Visit measurerain.com to order a Tropo today and use code RAINDAY, that's RAINDAY, for free shipping and 10% off. Go to MeasureRain.com.
Hey, Justin. Hey, everybody out there in Working Ranch Radio Land. Here's a presser that's been circulating all week, and it comes from the Competitive Markets Action, which is a 501c4 based in Washington, D.C. Their mission statement is, "We were formed with the mission of shaping policy to promote more regenerative and sustainable agriculture and competitive markets in the U.S. and to defend against attacks on states' rights by the federal government. CMA works to raise awareness of the harm caused by multinational conglomerates to the American family farmer, the consumer, and our U.S. economy as a whole in an effort to bring about legislative and regulatory reforms." Now, that's a mouthful mission statement, but I dig it. Now, here's the general crux of their presser. Chinese-owned Smithfield, which owns one in every six sows in America and whose purchase was financed by the Chinese Communist Party in 2013, has not been delisted by Holland and Knight, one of the largest lobbying firms in Washington, D.C., according to lobbying reports that also show the firm has been paid nearly $1 million representing the Chinese conglomerate over the past year. So here we've got a firm that is lobbying in Washington, D.C. on Chinese-owned Smithfield's behalf, and they're getting $1 million to do it. China's Smithfield continues to be a very serious and dangerous threat to the American farmers and ranchers and U.S. food production as the company continues to back and lobby for the EATS Act, the EATS Act. This dangerous legislation would nullify more than 1,000 state laws that protect American family farmers from a Chinese influence. The EATS Act and other legislation like it is opposed by more than 2,000 diverse opponents with millions of members that include Moms for America, Farm Action, Competitive Markets Action, the Organization of Competitive Markets, the American Grass-Fed Association, Kansas Cattlemen's Association, etc., etc. Now, here's a quote from Mike Schultz, founder of the Kansas Cattlemen's Association and vice president at the Organization for Competitive Markets. "Smithfield and their lobbyists should be banned from influencing our federal government and USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack, who continues to sell out American family farmers for China's gain. We must stand together in the face of Chinese threats like these. This isn't just about the one industry. It's about every one of us and the very plates on our kitchen table." Think about that, folks. Justin, let's dig down into that a little bit. Back to you in the studio.
All right. Thanks, Captain. And yeah, you know, it just brings to light even some of the concerns that we're seeing across many states. In fact, in 2023, there were a dozen states that enacted laws that would restrict foreign investment in agricultural lands. Now, more currently, we saw in the Senate version of the National Defense Authorization Act of 2024, they passed an amendment. That full bill went ahead and passed through the Senate. It's going into the House now. But that amendment that was added would prohibit China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran from purchasing U.S. farmland and agricultural companies. Now, according to USDA records, they say that 85% of Chinese investments in U.S. lands are situated in Texas, North Carolina, Missouri, Utah, and Virginia. The agency showing that five Chinese-owned companies own or control about 86% of that land. They are companies that you might know as Brazos Highland Companies. How about Murphy Brown LLC, but does business as Smithfield Foods. They also own about 97,000 acres in Missouri. Also doing business is Murphy Brown, aka Smithfield Foods, and Harvest Texas LLC, as well as Walton International Group. All of these Chinese-owned companies that do own acreage here in the United States. Now, what concerns many elected officials, though, is that the USDA cannot provide accurate and current reports on just how much land foreign investors do own in the United States or where that land is. And this comes according to a January 18th Government Accountability Office report. In fact, the GAO suggesting changes to the Agriculture Foreign Investment Disclosure Act reporting requirements for foreign-owned lands in the United States to ensure greater transparency and make it more difficult for foreign investors to buy land that might be used to undermine national security. So definitely something we all need to be watching at, and we'll continue to follow it here on the Working Ranch Radio Show as well. Well, let's switch subjects a bit now and turn and look towards our weather as meteorologist Don Day joins us with that long-term look. And Don, as we're here on this weekend, I know the north central part of the country and really up into Canada, a part of the country that really has been quite neglected through this winter, the moisture that we've seen in other parts of the country has been quite neglected. They're seeing it now.
Yeah, they really are. And this is important because it fits into the big picture in terms of the weather pattern, going back to the fact that the last time we talked about El Nino really fading and going away. And this has allowed the storm track now to take a little bit more of a northern path. So a lot of the northern Rockies and northern plains that have had a dry and pretty mild winter may be making up for it here in the coming weeks. And it's starting with a storm that came through late last week and at the beginning of the weekend. And now we've got this larger storm taking aim on the central and northern plains, and it's going to be a doozy for the Dakotas, Minnesota, parts of Nebraska, parts of Iowa, Wisconsin, and the northern Great Lakes. This may end up being their biggest winter storm of the season coming here in late March. And this is also going to stretch back across parts of Montana, parts of southern Alberta, Saskatchewan, and there's more coming.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about that more coming, what are you seeing? Because as this one is kind of north central up into Canada, centered in the U.S., we still see the west half of the country still seeing quite a bit of moisture in all. But as this one passes us by and we're looking ahead and these waves coming, are we going to see widespread across the U.S. or is it going to be one area over the other?
No, I think it's going to be the whole country. What we're going to see is a very active pattern, which is not that unusual. You expect March, and as you get into April, to see more stormy weather. And boy, we will. I think coast to coast, we're going to have very opportune chances for precipitation from the Pacific Northwest and California all the way to the Northeast and Southeast parts of the U.S., the Corn Belt. I don't think really there's any part of the country that won't be impacted by the stormy weather. And one thing we will see is this big contrast between the cold in the north and the warmer in the south will lead to quite a bit of severe weather.
Yeah.
Across the southern plains, the southeastern United States. This is the time of year when we see the frequency of tornado activity really start to go up. And the way the pattern's looking, the rest of March into early April, most of the lower 48, most of Canada are going to go to colder than average.
Okay.
And stay chilly. While there'll be some ups and downs in temperatures, we see a fairly significant storm coming off the Pacific and moving across the U.S. about every 3 to 4 days, starting with the pattern we have now, going through Easter weekend and going into the first couple of weeks of April.
Okay. And
as you were saying that, you said you're anticipating colder weather here coming up, and that usually indicates moisture in our discussions that we've had previously.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we see. We see a lot of Pacific moisture available. And the big contrast in air mass is that you get this time of year as the seasons change. The cold is still up north, and the cold is still up high in the upper reaches of the atmosphere. But as those lower latitudes to the south get warmer, that warmer air adds more humidity, because the warmer the air is, the more water can be in that air. And so when you see that colder air come in and come south, it just has more water available than it does in December or January or even February. So that's why a lot of times as we get into the spring season, the storms get bigger in terms of their potential to produce heavier rains and heavier snows.
I know this is something you keep track of. I haven't seen the data lately. I usually try to get it and take a look at it, but that is our snowpacks. What are you seeing across that? Is there any areas that you're concerned about? Or, and we definitely know there's been some areas down in the southwestern part of the country that's definitely seen a lot more snow. Snowpack levels, give me your breakdown on that.
Well, the best snowpack has been in the central and southern snowpack regions. You look at snowpack in California, Nevada, Utah, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, the southern drainages of Wyoming, that would be the upper North Platte, some of the Green River drainages, and the southern parts of Idaho and southern Oregon. Those locations I just mentioned have snowpacks that are either in the 90% of normal range or well over 100. They're going to do very well. They're going to have another good season. Where the snowpack has suffered because of that storm track we talked about at the beginning, where the storms have not been going into those northern areas, the snowpack areas I'm concerned about are Montana, northern Wyoming, northern Idaho, Washington State. The snowpacks just have not done as well because of that storm track. However, they may finish the season with more snow. So I think there's help on the way for those northern snowpack areas. Probably not enough to get them to normal levels, but help from the low levels that they have now.
You bet. Okay. Well, Don, appreciate it. Good outlook there for us in terms of moisture. We're all needing it. We all have appreciated the nicer weather for the most part that most of us have seen, but we also know we're going to need some moisture at some point. So I appreciate the outlook here today.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
All right. Thanks. And again, you can tune in each and every morning to meteorologist Don Day's video podcast at dayweather.com. It might be something that's quite insightful, especially as we find ourselves here in the springtime of the year with a lot of spring storms making their way across the country. Well, stay with us. Coming up, we'll put a wrap on this week's edition of the Working Ranch Radio Show. I want to give you a heads up of some of the future editions of the Working Ranch Radio Show and what we are working on. In fact, I encourage you to join us next week as Leo McDonald will be joining us as our guest. And now, if you've been in the ranching industry for any period of time, you're going to be very familiar with Leo and his work over the many, many years, not only as a rancher, and of course, Midland Bull Test is a name that might ring a bell there, is his work there, in addition to his advocacy that he has done on behalf of the cattle industry and various different aspects within that. More specifically, next week, we're going to be talking about the Truth in Labeling Act that has come down, the USDA closing some of those loopholes in regards to beef products that can have what can or can't have that product of the USA stamp on it. So we're going to be talking with Leo on that, and be sure to join us next week for that show. Also coming up in the following weeks, Dr. Michael Apley with Kansas State University joining us. He's just going to give us an update on the status of using antibiotics, growth promotants, and feed supplements to improve livestock efficiency. And also what we're working on for a show is to look at three different products in our industry from a new technology standpoint, not necessarily to endorse those products, but as a rancher myself, I have questions about them, and I thought that conversation that I have with those folks might be useful to you all as well. Now, if you heard something today, maybe you have questions about it or ideas for a show, please feel free to reach out to me. My email address is just
justin.workingranch@gmail.com. Well, the Working Ranch Radio Show is a production of Working Ranch Magazine, branded number one by America's Ranchers. Be looking for that next edition that is going to be coming out soon. And by the way, if you don't have a subscription yet, it's pretty simple to get started by going to workingranchmag.com. Thanks for joining us. I'm Justin Mills, and until next time, keep your chin down and your mind in the middle. So long.